All right, boys and girls, we are back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm your host, Ben Domenech. We are coming to you again on this day in which so many of you are quarantined or locked down across the country, and I want to send you good wishes. I know that a lot of you are dealing with different things depending on where you are, the levels of things being open, the levels of ability to see friends and family, to attend religious services, or to go out to eat or to businesses. And so our prayers and thoughts are with you. We're happy to be joined today by a friend of the show, Michael Hendricks. You can follow him on Twitter at Michael_Hendricks. He's the director of state and local policy at the Manhattan Institute, which you can follow at Manhattan Inst on Twitter. Michael, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today.
It's great to be with you.
I want to talk to you about a number of things, but first off, I have to ask you, as someone who is in New York, is a New Yorker in terms of your living experience, what are things like there at the moment?
Well, right now it's calmed down since the deaths from COVID-19 were peaking on or about April 6 or 7. At that moment, sirens were going day and night. It felt apocalyptic here. And the bad weather didn't help. It's been cold, it's been rainy. But over the past couple of weeks, you can finally sense that the city is not only coming back to life after being absolutely pummeled from coronavirus, but also it's just people want to get out. We've been in lockdown now for over 60 days. It's hard to believe. And we want to get out and go to our parks. And we would love to be able to talk with friends, except we really can't. And so now we enjoy the sun and we have our mask on. And we're grateful at least for a sense that the risk that we're facing from really confronting 5 September 11th, all in the span of 2 months, is maybe beginning to pass away. And that's a relief, but it's still a scary time. And we honestly don't know how or when we're really going to get back to anything resembling normality anytime soon.
I want to talk to you about the New York response and the politician side of things. But first, let's talk about the people, who are obviously more important. What was the community reaction like that you saw and witnessed during that period, both the apocalyptic period and then maybe the coming out of it? What have you seen or experienced in that time that has stuck out to you?
I think the number one thing that you'll notice is every 7 p.m., the city stops and people start clapping, horns start honking, and people cheer for the healthcare responders and those on the front lines. It's really invigorating. It gives you a sense of, like, this is why people in New York love New York. There's a sense of, we live in this really big city, but we're all in this together. Yeah, it can be a little rough and tumble, but everybody has each other's backs. And when times are really tough, that's often when New York is at its finest. And this is truly that. On the other hand, we realized how we often didn't choose our living circumstances or even to choose to live in New York because of all of the personal space that we get or all of the, you know, fantastically large living spaces that we would enjoy. No, we don't get any of that. And so, you know, all the people that decided to save some money and live in a studio or bunk up a bunch of the roommates discovered that that's a very tough living environment when you're home for long stretches of time. And we also didn't move here to you know, never enjoy our restaurants or beaches. Yes, we have beaches. Or Broadway or any other things that make New York special now. Those are the things we can't enjoy. And it's a really disconcerting fact of life in New York. Certainly we did not choose New York for its reputation for decades of fine leadership. But but we did come here also for, you know, an economy that you know, no matter what's happening with politics, has been strong, large, vibrant for many generations now. Even when times were bad, some of the largest corporations, some of the greatest inventors and minds in the world were all here. And it's I think, especially hard to know that something like at least 500,000 fellow New Yorkers are out of work, 90% of those working in hotels or out of work, and that is very tough. And there are people, there's a restaurant around the corner from me here who gives out free food. Even though they're struggling, they give out free food to people. They help out their community. We're seeing a lot of that here, but it's still hard. And frankly, I'm not sure that we or even our leaders really knew what we were going to face at this point in time. And we're certainly not really hearing a clear sense of what it's going to look like next.
One of the gaps that exists, obviously, between much of the country and New York City is the inability to go out and do very basic things without having to interact with a lot of people. I had this experience where I went from the front door of the apartment in New York to pick up a prescription at a CVS and then come back. And I just counted the number of people with whom I was within 6 feet, which itself is, by the way, an arbitrary measure that is probably insufficient, but you know, whatever, 6 feet. And I had to stop counting at around 50 just to go the handful of blocks to go there and come back. And that, you know, involved elevators and it involved, revolving doors and the like. The flip side is that for most Americans, many Americans who live in, you know, suburbs and the like, they can walk out their front door, get in their car, drive to the local pharmacy, pick up their prescription, drive through. Yeah, drive back and have interacted with within 6 feet of exactly one person. In terms of your own takeaway from this, we've seen the reports that lots of people are thinking, you know, I want to get away from density. Density is now an enemy. Public transportation is an enemy. I've got to get away from that. That's all mostly anecdotal. Like, we can't really measure that in terms of, except in a couple of, ephemeral kind of ways. Do you think that that's going to be something we see come out of this, especially among the people who have the flexibility to do it?
Well, I think that we're seeing in New York that temporarily many have fled. Some 400,000, I think, have left New York City since coronavirus hit. Literally half of the East Village fled. In similar numbers left Upper West Side, West Village, Upper East Side. Some of the wealthiest decamped to the Hamptons, to the suburbs, to South Florida. It's remarkable, by the way, that Florida has not gotten more deaths from coronavirus. Your chances of catching COVID-19 go up dramatically the closer you get to New York City. So I think you have to separate out New York City from all the other cities. And so the New York City is actually remarkably unique, terribly unique, frightfully unique when it comes to this virus. And how it's played out across New York, and we can get to other cities, but how it's played across New York has not really been a story of density being bad per se, or transit systems being bad per se, although they all played a role in spreading COVID-19. It's also been a story of kind of a tale of two cities. So if you live in Far Rockaway, which, by the way, Mayor de Blasio ran against a tale of two cities. COVID-19 has revealed the tale of two cities still exists. Far Rockaway, a very poor part of New York City, is getting like over 400 deaths per 100,000. But downtown, the Financial District or Battery Park City, you had precisely zero deaths per 100,000. Downtown New York City is very dense and it has a lot of transit connections, and yet the deaths aren't there. But a place like Far Rockaway, where yes, you can take the subway, but a lot of people drive too, had an enormous number of deaths. It tells you that there's other complicating factors related to comorbidities, your access to healthcare, things like that, which certainly those left of center pointed out could be an opportunity for making the case for more healthcare. But nevertheless, it is also just an example that, you know, it's not that the engine of New York's dynamism, its density and so many smart people being close together, is necessarily the harbinger of our death or the death of cities generally. It tells you that there's something else going on. And even with cars, Celine Firth, a friend of mine from Mercatus, showed that, look, you know, while Jeffrey Harris, a scholar from MIT, was able to show that transit played a role in spreading COVID-19. Celine Firth also said, you know, there actually doesn't seem to be a correlation between these transit lines and cases. There's actually a correlation with cars. Interestingly enough, somebody who is in a car can go, yes, to, we don't really have many drive-thrus in New York. They can go to the grocery store. They can go to other parts of their neighborhood. They're not really following a straight line of a transit system. They can spread a virus widely within their neighborhood with a car that a subway line struggles to do. And so I think we're really seeing that this is going to be complicated for us and be complicated for other cities. Whether or not the people who've moved away stay away, I don't know if we can make that determination just yet. I think a lot of people will realize that their jobs will want them to be present one way or another. Or as Facebook just announced today, if you're not going to be in the Bay Area, you are going to get a pay cut. Mm-hmm. And maybe your future job prospects would not look the same as it would be living in the Bay Area. So I would say that, you know, not only is density not destiny, but I would also say that those who believe reports of New York's death are, you know, those reports are greatly exaggerated.
Yeah. There's a number of decisions that have been made by people at the upper levels of authority, not just Mayor de Blasio and Governor Cuomo, but other officials as well, that have been questioned to the nth degree. One of the things that I think you know very well about New York is that because of its prominence and because it's one of the last places where there is a sizable, vibrant media population, since media has been hollowed out in so many other big cities, that every decision is, because of that, given a larger than life status, that the decisions about beaches there, for instance, are far more debated than decisions about beaches in other states. The decisions that stick out to you as being good ones and the decisions that stick out to you as being obviously bad ones, keeping in mind that looking back, we'll be able to make a data-based argument for this. But at this stage in particular, what do you view as being the smartest and the dumbest decisions that have been made?
Well, there have been a lot of dumb decisions. So I'll actually start with one of the good ones, at least. Mayor de Blasio called for a targeted lockdown of New York City before Governor Andrew Cuomo did. In fact, Governor Cuomo dismissed the calls for a shutdown that de Blasio was asking for, actually inspired from San Francisco Mayor London Breed's early move to shut down San Francisco. And I think that at least for New York City, if we had begun at least a targeted lockdown or quarantining in a serious way to communities that were suffering the most, if we had done that earlier, there's a strong chance that this would not have become as big of a problem that it has for New York, or that New York would have spread so much of the virus across the Eastern Seaboard, similar to how Seattle spread the virus that they got from China, us from Europe, it appears, but spread the virus across the Western Seaboard. But you know, de Blasio doesn't get a pass here. De Blasio was saying in early March that he's encouraging New Yorkers to, quote, go on with their lives and get out on the town despite coronavirus. In fact, even encouraging New Yorkers to go see a film about a mafia mob boss. You know, that's not something that we consider to be normal now. And even calls that we had nationally to not wear masks, I think also really hurt us at the beginning when we could have put a lid on this virus and we didn't. So we just kind of dithered. And it was revealed that many of the masks that we had stockpiled under Mayor Bloomberg, many of the ventilators that we had stockpiled under Mayor Bloomberg had either been disposed of under de Blasio because he said it was too expensive. It was $100,000 a year. Meanwhile, he's spending $250 million a year in his wife's own mental health program. But, you know, they let N95 masks expire, which, by the way, you can still use them at the very least for non-medical uses. But just let them expire and just said, well, the heck with it. We're done.
Can I interrupt you for just a moment? Because there are many more bad decisions to get to, but I just wanted to give you a little perspective on why we left New York in early March. The experience that we had was this. I'm not the most crowd friendly person. I'm not skittish about crowds, but I don't like them especially when things like this start to go on. And there were a couple of elements of this that I noticed. One was, even as news reports were increasing, the behavior of New Yorkers, especially within crowded places like supermarkets, was not changing at all. They really were not spacing out. Very few people were changing things. I remember walking into a Morton Williams, a supermarket, and seeing a group of people who were all lined up next to each other, all getting things from the hot buffet, and just standing over it and breathing over it. So that made me a little paranoid. The other thing that I noticed is that very few people were wearing masks at that point. And while we live in an area that has a higher percentage of the Asian population, who you frequently see wearing masks anyway, like even outside of this type of thing, we had had an experience where in January, coming back from a trip, there had been a number of boxes to pick up, packages and the like. And there was a package that was given to us by accident, which my wife opened, and it was a Chinese package addressed to a Chinese name, and it was a massive amount of N95 masks. And I just I took it back down and I gave it to the front person. And just thinking at the time, remember, this is back in January when we were told this was nothing. And I just thought to myself, that's weird. I don't really usually see those. I see like the normal, cloth masks or the like. I don't really see these, high octane ones that I knew as being used for cleaning out mold and the like. There were just a series of things like that that made me increasingly paranoid and wanting to get out of the city. And it just seems to me at the time that as politicians were trying to navigate this, they were stuck between trying to balance the interests of communities to maintain normalcy, maintain their traditions, and continue in the entertainment and tourist business that makes so much of New York's economy thrive, and all of the actual tensions that were beginning to emerge between that existence and the medical reality. I don't know, that other people who would have been more on the ball, I think maybe some of them would have, but it's just interesting to me that the decisions that that de Blasio made were very much in keeping with this idea that people needed to get out there and live their lives and keep things going without necessarily sending a stronger warning that might have maybe resulted in a little bit of a different behavior on the part of some New Yorkers.
Right. It's hard to remember as you walk through the neighboring neighborhood of Park Slope where I live, and you see everyone with masks. And everybody is now drafted as a social distance warrior. That not that long ago, nobody was wearing masks, really. I mean, you rarely saw that. Social distancing wasn't really a thing. People began to elbow bump, but they'd kind of do that with a chuckle, a laugh. But we really didn't, there wasn't a sense that anybody was taking it seriously. And so I think we need to be careful to look back at some of those decisions and say, well, clearly we would have done better. It's the communities, I think, in especially Southeast Asia that had dealt with SARS before were the ones who took this very seriously. They immediately were shutting down the border or conducting temperature checks. They were, everyone was wearing masks. And those kind of quick decisions right at the beginning, they knew to make them because they've seen this before. It's been generations since we'd seen something like this. And, that kind of quick action could have saved us so much trouble. And instead, now we really don't know when we're going to get back to normal. And in the meantime, tens of thousands have died and hundreds of thousands have been sickened. I'll also share an anecdote too. I came back from honeymoon right at the beginning of March. And, you know, when we were coming through the airport from abroad.
By the way, congratulations on being last folks to be able to have that happen.
Exactly. So. But, you know, we were coming through immigration, and it took us 5 minutes to get through immigration. They asked us one question. Did you go to China? We said no, we hadn't. And the other 4.5 minutes talking about the immigration officer's love of Kentucky bourbon. That was it. And if you had just fast forwarded from that moment, 1 week later, it would have been night and day, night and day. And it would have been absolute chaos at the airports, because the airports certainly didn't know what they were doing, and our leaders didn't know either.
So get back to the earlier question. There's all these decisions, this kind of cascade of decisions that comes. The perspective that I have, and I have to admit I'm biased, I deeply despise Bill de Blasio, in part because I have been going back and forth between Washington and New York for years. I mean, going back to really the past 8 years of my life, 8 or 9 years of my life, I've been going back and forth from D.C. to New York. At minimum, I would say every 2 to 3 weeks, and at maximum, every couple days. And so because of that, because you have some distance from the city, you see things change. And under de Blasio, I actually saw this city that I used to really like to visit, really gain a number of signs of decay. And by that, I don't mean anything resembling, you know, the New York of the 70s and that type of thing. I mean, come on, you know, it's not reverting to a pre-Giuliani New York. But it did seem like every week the trash piles would get bigger, and they would hang out in front of buildings longer. And every week there was, you know, another tale of someone having to get off a train because somebody was masturbating, and rather than deal with it, you know, everybody just moved cars, you know. And it just was one of these things of the little signs of a city that has some bad things going on with it, you know, just increased and increased. It was very amusing to me to go in and watch the movie Joker and have the very first thing they talk about be the garbage strike that's going on, because it just felt like that in terms of what we were seeing. And walking out of these very high-end buildings where, you know, famous actors and rich people live, walking out to the street and just having like an awful smell come over you and say, who are these people paying these amazing amounts of money every month to live in these penthouses? And then they have to come out here and they have to smell the same crap that I do. It was jarring. And so I have I really despise de Blasio as a leader anyway. I feel like he's gotten even worse. I mean, just observing from far away, I'm like, I thought you were bad before. You found a new level of bad. But that's just my opinion. So tell me if I'm right in that. Tell me if I'm wrong. But maybe walk us through some of the decisions he's made that you question.
Yeah. So you get the sense now that we're kind of living a replay, just maybe at the beginning of the 1970s. And it's actually interesting when you hear people who were around from the 1970s fiscal crisis, if you remember, or mm-hmm. remember reading about the headline, Ford to City, Drop Dead. Yes. That was that time. The people who lived during the 70s actually compare us to now and believe the 70s were better because at least, quote, giants walked the earth, you know, at least we had leaders, right? And so while we may be wealthier now, there's bike lanes and, you know, look at all this great stuff that actually came into place under Mayor Bloomberg, mm-hmm. let's add, that we're really lacking is leadership now. And I think you really see that, set aside some of the mistakes made during the crisis, you really see that now as we're trying to figure out how to get out of this crisis. Like, look at the kind of, you know, $9 to $10 billion budget gap that New York City is now facing because of a catastrophic decline in tax revenues. Mayor de Blasio's first move was to say, you know, don't worry, we're not going to cut your salary. We're still going to send $1.5 billion in back pay to pay for cuts that Bloomberg made under the last recession to teachers in order to balance the books. So we're still paying for salaries for hours worked 11 years ago. That's still in the budget, right? That's crazy. We will close pools. We will cut funding to parks, right? We will ensure that you can never go to city beaches. But oh, by the way, definitely go to Long Island beaches, because at least that's outside of the city. It's someone else's problem, right? Those are the things you begin to see, and you think, is anybody taking this seriously? I mean, there's tons of good ideas out there about how to deal with garbage or how to make our subways more efficient. But what do we do? I mean, that all requires leadership. What we do is we kick out Andy Byford, the global leader who we brought in to transform our subway system. We kick him out. There are ideas out there about how to put garbage in bins if you don't have alleyways, like New York doesn't. But we don't do anything about that. We actually have ideas about how to keep social distancing and half capacity in open restaurants by allowing open air dining on sidewalks and parking lanes and open streets. But we say, at best, Mayor de Blasio said, I'm too busy to think about that. Or his DOT commissioner said, it's a great idea, we're going to form a committee to think about it, right? And you realize that the real problem here is kind of two things. One is that Mayor de Blasio is kind of a micromanager who surrounds himself with insiders. And you see that, except for some really bright stars, he's kind of staffed by the B and C teams. Under Bloomberg, which by no means perfect, he was the opposite. He was a delegator. He was infamous or famous for getting the best and brightest from anywhere. So if you're a really smart mayor from Indianapolis, we're going to bring you in here like Steve Goldsmith to be our deputy mayor, because you're really good at what you do. And if there's a great idea for bike lanes or open air dining, let's do it. And let's make it temporary to lower the barriers to new ideas being implemented. And then once we get past the entrenched interests, we'll make it permanent. But here the entrenched interests still dominate. Mayor de Blasio, Andrew Cuomo, they're still beholden to those interests. Like, for instance, you see that with delays in contact tracing. Mayor de Blasio was going to have the health department take the lead on contact tracing and eventually yanked it from them because it would lead to non-unionized workers getting jobs. Hmm. And he instead gave it to the hospital department, which were unionized, right? It's little things like that that means that while the public sector is satisfied and unions are satisfied, it's really the private sector and regular citizens that really get the raw deal.
Tell me, Michael, if I was speaking today instead to Deputy Mayor Michael Hendricks, what would you be prioritizing as just a handful of things you would like to do or change about de Blasio's policies at the moment?
Well, I mean, there's actually a plan that we rolled out with Arpit Gupta from NYU, an adjunct fellow at Manhattan Institute, and Dr. Jonathan Ellen, doctor, and also reviewed by the expert who had actually planned under Bloomberg for an outbreak of the coronavirus flu in New York. He'd actually written a plan for this that we somehow forgot, right? And we said, look, this is actually relatively simple. If you think about, we need to have a stage reopening where we let those who are younger, healthier workers back to work. Nobody's forcing them back to work, but younger, healthier workers are much less likely, especially children, to be vulnerable to COVID-19, especially if they have no other comorbidities. And let ensure that everybody's wearing masks. Like, look, we have complicated. We're shutting down our New York City subway system overnight. We're doing all the sort of complicated cleaning and disinfecting. Look, if you just say, if you want to get on the subway system, you have to have a mask on, at least for the time being. And if you don't have a mask, we'll give you a mask. That actually solves most of the problems that we have with our subway, right? It helps prevent the spread of the virus and allows for some degree of social distancing, but it doesn't have to be 6 feet. Those kind of measured steps of allowing younger, healthy workers in, basic measures like mask wearing, yes, contact tracing, testing, all that kind of stuff. We kind of all know this now. But but also allowing the city to kind of come back to life and understand how that's affecting hospitalization. I think that if we just take a calm, measured approach to this, it needn't be rocket science. And in fact, a big part of this is just having a plan, releasing a plan that's very clear with a clear timetable. We actually still miss that. Yes, there's a multi-stage state Cuomo-led plan for reopening, but it's still unclear when New York will reopen, when certain businesses will reopen, what it will look like. Even the commission to advise Governor Cuomo on the business community has 135 members.
Yeah.
And that's one of numerous task forces across the state and city government. And if you have hundreds, if not thousands of people that are part of your task force, you don't really have task forces.
Yeah. At a certain point, isn't this just avoidance of the consequences of leadership? You know, trying to get, you know, a situation where, hey, let's rope all of ourselves together and then come up with some kind of bland path, as opposed to making a tough decision that says there are risks entailed, but this is what we're going to do.
Right, exactly. It often feels like spreading the responsibility or spreading the blame rather mm-hmm. than taking real leadership.
You know, I have observed, obviously, the respect that the media has been giving to Governor Cuomo in his briefings, and the praise that they've given him has elevated his poll numbers. At the same time, I mean, I think that we're seeing a backlash that's rising against him, one that was voiced by Governor Ron DeSantis just yesterday of Florida, who was basically pointing out, you guys said that Florida was going to be the next New York. We were going to be the next hot zone, the next epicenter. You know, I accepted the most visitors, the most folks traveling here from New York of any place. And yet, you know, we were able to deal with this. And basically by doing the opposite of what New York did when it came to our treatment of nursing homes, which is, I think, overwhelmingly responsible for a lot of that difference. What do you think the actual attitude should be towards Andrew Cuomo's performance? And why do you think we haven't gotten a clear perspective yet of why they did what they did related to nursing homes?
I don't know if we'll know for the time being or anytime soon why Governor Cuomo made the decisions he did for nursing homes. I think it's absolutely incredible that Ron DeSantis has not gotten the credit he's gotten for a targeted approach for the most vulnerable populations. That's really what it means to have leadership on coronavirus, is saying, like, look, we'll look at the data, we'll have a targeted approach for lockdowns, we'll recognize that in some places, especially if you act early, a complete lockdown may not even be necessary, especially if it's tied with social distancing. This is something that Lyman Stone mm-hmm. has been exploring, and saying, like, look, if it's nursing homes that in New York have had more deaths just in nursing homes than in all of Florida, then maybe that's actually where we need to be, A, stopping people from going into, which was the opposite of Governor Cuomo's approach. He was pushing people into nursing homes, which is incredible. But also being able to say, look, if you are in a vulnerable spot, we will create, let's say, COVID-only nursing homes to just safely quarantine sick populations. That's actually something that Governor DeSantis did down in Florida. Mm-hmm. And then as we're reopening in New York, you're seeing a regional approach. So someplace in upstate New York that has had very few cases can open up much sooner than New York City, which is actually reasonable, but could have been the approach that we also took to the lockdown, yes. Saying that if you're a green zone, you're fine. If you're a red zone, you're not fine. We're going to have very different responses. This is also what we should be doing across America, saying, you know, New York is going to be very different than New Mexico, and New Mexico very different than Florida. And so that kind of state-by-state governor-led approach is actually a good thing. And I'm not sure that Governor Cuomo should be getting as much praise as his brother on CNN has been giving him.
Well, you know, I'm still waiting for him to ask him a really tough question. He was
instead he has a large, I believe, what is it? Was it a
Q-tip?
Oversized Q-tip that he
prop comedy. That's what we need at times like these. Michael, in a certain sense, is this kind of a failure of federalism? And by that, I don't mean the system, but the American ability to understand federalism. We've talked over the years before, even you and I, about the dangers of nationalizing every debate. You know, we experienced this through a lot of different debates in the social policy realm, for instance, you know, nationalizing the gun debate, you know, in the way that things are treated, nationalizing the abortion debate, nationalizing the marriage debate, and that basically people, you know, want, they hear about things, they see things on the news, and they want to have one policy that covers the whole country. You know, and it's the same when people start talking about getting rid of the Electoral College or something like that. To me, this was an element where federalism could have been a very good thing, a healthy thing, where we looked at the differences between states, the differences between their experiences, and said, to your point, you're in a green zone, red zone, you know, there's much higher risk here, there's much lower risk here. Let's let states and localities determine the way things should go. And instead, you have a situation where entire states will be shut down when there's just one area in particular that accounts for an overwhelming percentage of the cases. You have states that it seems locked down way too early. They might be reopening way too early too, you know, in terms of the way these things play out. We don't know yet. But it's a situation where I think that the power of the national media, the New York-based national media, to direct this led to a lot of decisions across the country that don't actually make sense given the differences in experience. Is that something that we can actually learn from? Or is this going to be another situation where the politics involved is going to prevent people from looking back on this and saying, hey, maybe states should be a little bit more directed at their own situation and be able to withstand the pressure of national media to drive narratives?
Well, Ben, I think if it should be clear that everything, literally everything, is downstream of the culture war at this point.
Yeah.
So yes, it will be politicized. Yes, it, you know, the responses of each individual state will be looked at through a political lens. It'll be part of a red state, blue state fight. But if we just take a step back and look at, for instance, just really briefly, another country like Germany. Tony Mills had a great piece in the New Atlantis arguing that Germany's relative success relative to the rest of the world in fighting COVID-19, part of their success came down to their decentralized system and their decentralized response to the pandemic. They have, for instance, a decentralized laboratory system that was able to respond swiftly and effectively to the pandemic. And it was enabled by their decentralized politics. Instead, too often in America, in our response so far, we looked first to the CDC and we tried to centralize things with the CDC. And the CDC quickly became overwhelmed and made mistakes. Mm-hmm. What do you know? People in federal government make mistakes. And sometimes we have a failure of leadership, right? And so we should actually be encouraged when some governors actually stand up and say, we're going to go a different path. We're going to take a different path. And even if we're going to get slammed for it, Governor DeSantis got slammed for, you know, even having a decentralized approach within his own state. Governor Bill Lee from Tennessee also got slammed too. And what do you know? After the fact, it turns out they actually, their states came out looking really good compared to other states that tried a more centralized approach or even sometimes acted too quickly because they saw what was happening in, let's say, New York and thought, well, this is going to happen immediately in our state and maybe even shut down too early such that when the real outbreaks began to hit or even now are beginning to hit, their populations are rightly restless and saying, look, we've been in the lockdown, haven't been a a huge outbreak where we are, but we certainly lost our jobs. What's going on, right? And then it could be difficult to keep a lid on things anymore. And so I think this should be, to your point, a great argument for federalism. And that should be a message that should go not just to governors and mayors, but also to our public health system that all too often does want to centralize the response. I think this should be a lesson learned for them. Certainly, I'm not a public health expert, but I hope from what I'm seeing that we all can learn, even the experts out there, learn from our response and figure out how we can do better, not just in the second wave, but for some future outbreak that we are surely going to get.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting to me, by the way, that Jared Polis out in Colorado sounds a lot more like Kristi Noem than he does like Andrew Cuomo.
That's right.
You know, and Polis, I think, should be as one of the most progressive governors in the state, you know, maybe only beaten in the states, maybe only beaten by Jay Inslee or a couple of others, you know, is someone that should be receiving more attention for the approach that he's used.
Absolutely.
As a Western state. I in the time we have left, I know that you are an expert on state and local policy. You're very interested in city planning and urbanism and the different approaches that are used there. I've heard a lot of different conflicting and sometimes interesting predictions about what we're going to see happen because of this pandemic at that level. What are some of the things that you find to be interesting or appealing, predictions that seem to you to be pretty accurate in the direction that we might take after all this is done?
Like I said at the outset, people who are saying that cities are going to die or die off, or that people are going to flee cities, I don't think really understand how cities have reacted to these crises over time. Cities have literally been built based upon their response to pandemics. They've been formed in pandemics. And we just, I think, got a little complacent. And, you know, if some parts of a very successful city become cheaper all of a sudden, for whatever reason, there's going to be someone else that'll say, I want to take part in New York City again. If the West Village gets cheaper, there's going to be somebody who wants to move in there. You know, I moved to New York because I believe in cities and I believe in New York. And I think you should want New York City to be the sort of place where anyone can make it. And right now, that's not the case. If you're poor or lack a college education, too often you're better off somewhere else. And also, if you're poor or lack a college education, as we've seen with COVID-19, you're more likely to get sick. And you're less able to lead when times get tough. Well, those who are, let's say, highly educated or are a trustafarian, they are able to decamp to the Hampton. They are able to get out and work remotely for a time. You know, our city should be a place of opportunity. That has almost always been the story in America. And it is still the story today in other global cities. It's just not that case in New York City, especially, and in far too many other great cities across America. So I think the number one lesson coming out of this should be, we need to restore growth and opportunity to New York City and many other cities that have taken growth for granted. We're going to need that now more than ever as our budgets, as our budgets are sunk, as our pension bills come due, and as we need to restore the hundreds of thousands or millions of jobs that we've lost in this crisis. And I firmly believe that we can do that. And I want us to actually have housing policies that work, that where there's demand, you can build. I want us to have transportation systems that aren't clogged with congestion. And that's gonna be a state-by-state, locality-by-locality answer, but we're not even fixing our highways or fixing our buses, and instead too often spending money on boondoggles. We need to be fixing our finances, certainly. And, you know, we need to be able to actually have leaders who are willing to step up and say, you know, it's great to run a business, it's great to run a nonprofit, it's great to be a young person. I need to participate And one of the things that we're going to be fighting for at MI is to kind of help make local democracy work, because it's kind of broken right now. And the more we can get good leaders out there, I hope that we can not only have an answer for these policy questions, but we'll not make the sort of mistakes that we've seen here in New York again, especially in the next pandemic. We can do better. And I firmly believe that with the right ideas and the right people, we will.
Michael Hendricks is Director of State and Local Policy at the Manhattan Institute. You can follow him on Twitter at @Michael_Hendricks. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today, Michael.
Thank you, Ben.
I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. We'll be back soon with more. Until then, dear lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.